Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Getting It Done, and I'm your host, Dr. Walter Dean. You know, it's very interesting how there are people who listen to your show want to know why you don't have some music or something at the very beginning of the show. And I told them that I figured it was a waste of time playing some music when I had other things that were worth doing. Then I had something else that another person wrote me and indicated. They said, why are you doing so many shows about slavery? Well, when we look at what is happening to black people today, we find really some scary things. Like so many of them being killed by police. So many of them are dying from the pandemic, disease that we have floating around here in all the different states and actually around the world. And children are now not able to get an education, or there's a fear of them going back to school, and there's a big old epidemic down in Florida, especially in Dade County, where a large percentage of black people live, the lack of jobs or work, black colleges are closing because of lack of funds. There's so many things that are pushing us back in that direction. So, you know, I mean, we could just not pay any attention to these things, especially when you have so many black people in jail. Things have not been as bad as they are now since slavery. And so what is happening in this past to get here, what is happening? What has happened to get us back to where we are presently? So someone told me a long time ago, if you don't pay attention to history, you're subject to repeat it. And many of these statements will be in today's show, a review of things to come, or if we can avoid them, we'll find out, because we got a man that sits up in the White House who doesn't think that he thinks he's a king, and therefore we might be in for a rude awakening. Today's call, Enslavement to Emancipation. So let's pay close attention and see what happens.
Gonna take a trip this evening. Gonna go way back home. Gonna look at your past
Imagine being kidnapped or sold into captivity, forced into submission through violent beating, torture, and intimidation, sold on the auction block to the highest bidder, and being forced to work for free under the most cruel, deplorable conditions. And it's all perfectly legal. This was the existence for blacks enduring the horrific institution of enslavement in our nation's early years. For enslaved blacks, it was more than being forced to work without compensation, but a way of life, reaching every crack and crevice of human existence.
After 1620, when indentured servitude was changed into the permanent state of slavery, permanent state of the institution of slavery, the Virginia colonists passed a series of laws that are called the slave codes. And these slave codes are codified into law to restrict and prohibit enslaved people from having access to government, from having access to private enterprise, as well as prohibiting enslaved people from having relationship between wife to husband, husband to children, and subsequently the ownership of property. Complete prohibition in every phase of life to control and maintain enslaved people as property of slave owners or slave masters.
Just as the District of Columbia, nation's capital, was carved out of land from Maryland and Virginia, so too were its slave laws. But by the early to mid-1800s, with the number of free blacks growing in the district and the anti-slavery movement picking up steam, the climate in our nation's capital began to change.
We, as a human race, should never suppress, never enslave, never oppress, and never treat our fellow humans indifferent. The lesson from this is that freedom, liberation, equality, and justice should be for all, and oppression and slavery for none.
As the symbolic center of a young nation, the struggle to end slavery in the District of Columbia had more meaning than in any other place in the Union.
Slavery in the District of Columbia is significant because Washington, D.C. is the capital of the United States. This was not lost on slaveholders. It wasn't lost on the abolitionists, nor was it lost on the enslaved population and the free black population. They realized that the fight for emancipation in the district would be a fight for freedom throughout the United States.
In 1833, the American Anti-Slavery Society was founded in Philadelphia. Its members flooded Congress with thousands of petitions demanding an end to slavery and the slave trade in the district. Hoping to avoid a brutal showdown on Capitol Hill, members of the House of Representatives devised a strategy known as the gag rule, which automatically postponed or tabled any petitions on the over 100,000 anti-slavery petitions sent to the House of Representatives.
We have scores of petitions and memorials that were received by Congress from progressive white communities, from African Americans. We have letters and so forth. So that is a battle that went from the designation of Washington, D.C. as the national capital.
Former President John Quincy Adams, then in his 70s, began a 9-year battle against the gag rule, which was finally repealed in 1844. While the legislative battle against slavery raged on Capitol Hill, freed blacks and white abolitionists in the district played a critical role in a clandestine effort to move enslaved persons to freedom, known as the Underground Railroad.
The Chesapeake, I'm talking about Virginia, Maryland, D.C., and Delaware, the Upper South, is the pathway from slavery to freedom because you have an area in which individuals, black and white, are going to actively aid those seeking freedom. All they have to do is to get across the Potomac or somehow catch a boat across the bay, get to Baltimore, and from there they can go to Delaware, they can make it to Philadelphia, they can make it to New Jersey, they can make it to New York.
Among the many African Americans in Washington who risked their lives hiding fugitive slaves was Anthony Bowen. Bowen was born enslaved in Maryland in 1805. He later moved to Washington, where as a young man he purchased his freedom in 1830 for $425. A dedicated abolitionist and religious leader, Bowen met freedom seekers at the 6th Street Wharf and sheltered them in his home, which served as an important stop along the Underground Railroad.
Washingtonians worked to guarantee freedom, not just for themselves, but for individuals like my great-great-grandfather, a slave in Virginia. They made freedom real for individuals all over the nation.
In 1853, Bowen organized the nation's first African-American YMCA in Washington. Throughout the early 1800s, the brutality of the institution of slavery was routinely on display in the nation's capital. The markets that sprang up in Washington, D.C., formed the busiest area in the country for the buying and selling of slaves. For abolitionists, the slave markets located in the center of the nation represented what they called the national shame.
This practice of purchasing and selling slaves in the district had become an embarrassment for the national government. And many Europeans as visitors to the nation's capital took this nation to task to see this heart-wrenching selling of individuals separating children from mothers, it was very difficult.
Although opponents to slavery were ever more vocal, slavery in the District of Columbia continued throughout the early 1800s. By 1835, however, those who held people enslaved were increasingly concerned by a series of insurrections and escape attempts. Memories were still fresh of Nat Turner's 1831 rebellion, just 180 miles south of D.C. in Southampton, Virginia. Turner and a band of runaway slaves had killed upwards of 50 white people with axes before it all came to an end. The violent and dramatic incident was now on the minds of the residents of the district. In August of that year, a peculiar confrontation between an 18-year-old slave named Arthur Bowen and a 60-year-old white socialite named Mrs. Anna Marie Thornton set off a series of explosive events.
One evening, after engaging in a debate at the 15th Street Presbyterian Church, Arthur Bowen was inebriated at the time and was walking into the house. And as he walked into the house, he picked up an axe and put it on his arm as he was walking in. Anna Marie Thornton, Marie Bowen, who was Arthur Bowen's mother, was in the bedroom. And when he walked in, he startled them. And as a result of startling them, Anna Marie Thornton rushes out of the house, and she was met by the position of Andrew Jackson. And she shared the story of Arthur Bowen walking into the house with an axe on his arm. Then it becomes a part of an alleged attack on the mistress, Anna Marie Thornton, which created the chaos and the havoc that took place, known as the Snow Riots of 1835 here in the District of Columbia.
The alleged attack became just one of several sparks that would soon set off an outbreak of violence in the nation's capital.
Once Arthur Bowen was captured and incarcerated at the D.C. jail, which was located in Judiciary Square, the Irish mechanics, who were angry because they felt that the enslaved persons were taking jobs away from them, and with the backdrop of the Nat Turner insurrection of 1831 and to avenge the alleged attack on Anna Marie Thornton, they wanted to get Arthur Bowen out of jail and then hang him. The policeman prohibited the mechanics from gaining access to Arthur Bowen. So subsequently, they marched down the street to 6th and Pennsylvania Avenue. They destroyed the restaurant of Beverly's Night because they could not gain access to Arthur Bowen. One has to realize that by 1835, the number of African Americans who were free outnumbered the number of enslaved African Americans who just went. So that played into the attitude and the behavior of the Irish mechanics. Let me just emphasize that that during this period, mechanics are basically laborers in the city, general laborers in the city. And so they waged this campaign of terror on Beverly Snow as an example or as a symbol to suppress the abolitionist movement, to suppress the movement for freedom, liberation, and equality and emancipation. So therefore, Beverly Snow's restaurant becomes a symbol of their attack. Arthur Bowen was found guilty of attempted murder on Anna Marie Thornton. Anna Marie Thornton knew and felt that Arthur Bowen truly was not trying to attack her, and she started a petition to free Arthur Bowen. Through that petition, Andrew Jackson stayed execution three times. On the third appeal for Anna Marie Thornton, he pardoned Arthur Bowen. And this is the role that he played in the Snow Riot of 1835, which should probably be called the Arthur Bowen Riot rather than the Beverly Snow Riot, because it was more about Arthur Bowen than it was about Beverly Snow.
In 1848, the District of Columbia was home to a combustible mix of slaves, freed blacks, pro-slavery whites, and abolitionists. It was also the setting for the single largest attempted slave escape in U.S. history, a daring and dramatic bid for freedom aboard the Pearl.
It's very hard to have any precise picture, but it is estimated that throughout the country, about 1,000 slaves per year either ran away or tried to run away. But the penalty for running away was very high, very high. Sometimes, if they lived in the Upper South where life was not too hard, they were sold to New Orleans. Sometimes they were beaten viciously.
Nearly 37,000 people lived in the district at that time. About 8,000 of them were free black people, and 4,000 were slaves. Some tried to buy their freedom. Others tried to run away, often by way of the Underground Railroad. William Chaplin, a radical abolitionist known for helping several slaves escape, was enlisted by a free black couple, Daniel and Mary Bell, who were trying to secure the freedom of their own children. It was the Bells who initiated the planning for the Pearl escape.
When the Bells asked him to arrange for 10, this was a very large number and very difficult. And this is why he asked a man he knew in Philadelphia to arrange for a ship, and that's how the Pearl got involved.
That Philadelphia man was Daniel Drayton, a ship's captain who once helped a family of 6 slaves escape.
Daniel Drayton himself was a Methodist who had become alienated from the Methodist Church because he felt they did not try to end slavery. He had a large family. He realized that they were in want, and for that reason, he most reluctantly accepted the $100 offered to him for bringing off the slaves. He knew how dangerous it was.
Drayton sought the help of Edmund Sayers, also a ship's captain, who owned a schooner called the Pearl. Reduced to using the Pearl for hauling and selling coal, Sayers reluctantly agreed to come to Washington because he needed the $100. Paul Edmondson, a free black man and father of another large family of slaves, was also seeking freedom for his children aboard the Pearl. Because his wife Amelia was a slave, 14 of her children were legally slaves also. And as soon as the children reached the appropriate age, their owner rented them out.
It was because they were rented out in Washington that they heard about a ship coming to take the Bell family to freedom. And so they approached Chaplin and said, could we get on board the ship? And so they were among the people who waited with bated breath to find out whether or not they would be allowed to get on board the Pearl. When Drayton said, I'll take anybody that wants to come, the Edmondsons were among the first to get on board. That
was supposed to be a commercial right now, but evidently that's not going to happen.
No. 76 slaves, men, women, and the children, slipped down to the ship and got on board. I think so often of how desperate people were to achieve freedom. Because think of what the Pearl was like. It was a broken down old schooner. It had been hauling coal. Nobody did anything to clean it up. And yet they were grateful. They were willing. They were anxious to get on board.
So on the evening of April 15, 1848, the passengers aboard the Pearl, old and young, male and female, mothers with children, set sail on a daring 225-mile quest for freedom. But by daylight, their slave owners realized something was amiss.
They recognized the next morning because all of the things that domestic slaves were supposed to do had not been done. They were absolutely furious.
A posse soon formed and set out in a steamboat on the Potomac to capture the runaway slaves.
When the steamboat saw the pearl, there was much shouting and hallelujahing because they had found the ship that they were looking for.
Drayton and Sayers were taken on board the steamboat, and the pearl was tugged back up the Potomac to Washington, where they anchored at the foot of 7th Street. But it was sisters Mary and Emily Edmondson who later would become the Pearl's most famous passengers.
As they marched up 7th Street, this is in downtown Washington, the crowd grew much larger. By this time, the crowd had grown threatened with the cries of lynch him, the damned villains. There were taunts and jeers at every step. According to another account, people were shouting, drag him out, knock his damned brains out, shoot him, shoot the hellhound. One of the bystanders is supposed to have said to fugitive Emily Edmondson, aren't you ashamed to run away and make all this trouble for everybody? She replied, no, sir, we are not, and if we had to go through it again, we'd do the same thing.
The runaway slaves were returned to their owners, and most of them were sold. But it was sisters Mary and Emily Edmondson who later would become the Pearl's most famous passengers. Drayton and Sayers were found guilty of transporting slaves for the purpose of escape and sentenced to long prison terms. But a few years later, President Millard Fillmore decided to pardon Drayton and Sayers. Yet after the Pearl's capture, Mary and Emily Edmondson and four of their brothers were quickly shipped off to the lucrative slave market of New Orleans. The brothers were easily sold, but Mary and Emily's story didn't end there.
They were beautiful, they were young, and they had lovely singing voices. And so it was assumed they would be sold to the fancy girls in New Orleans. But then it appeared that they were in peril of catching whatever fever it was that was killing people in New Orleans. And so they were sent back, first to Baltimore and then to Alexandria, where they hoped that somebody would die that fever.
The Edmondson sisters were eventually freed and educated with the help of noted abolitionist Reverend Henry Ward Beecher and his sister, Harriet Beecher Stowe. Though Mary died young, Emily Edmondson became an abolitionist herself and went on to work with Frederick Douglass and others. The human drama at the center of the attempted escape on the Pearl mirrored the deepening drama of the coming Civil War.
This was a terrible thing that had happened. It was a terrible thing because it had happened right next to the capital of the United States. And consequently, people all over the South were totally enraged. And I suspect this incident was one of the reasons that the search for fugitive slaves was really tightened up in a law that was passed known as the Compromise of 1850, which made it obligatory to help people recover the slaves. Now, also a part of that law was a measure providing that the slave trade would be ended in the district, not slavery. Slavery remained until 1862, but it was at least a recognition that there was by this time in the United States a growing opposition to the institution of slavery.
Providing compensation to slave owners was not a new idea in 1862. In fact, as early as 1833, Great Britain abolished slavery and compensated slave owners for their freed slaves. The idea was tested in the nation's capital with the help of a dedicated abolitionist, Massachusetts Senator Henry Wilson.
He was a man not only who empathized with enslaved people, and not only who was horrified by seeing it firsthand on his visits to the district, he deserves to be much better recognized. Not only is the author of Compensated Emancipation of the District, but he would also go on to write the law that would smash the black codes in D.C. He would introduce the first post-Civil War civil rights legislation. He would be the 18th Vice President of the United States under Grant and Chairman of the Military Affairs Committee of the Union during the Civil War. And yet, if you go to his grave, it's a plain stone sepulcher with no mention of all of these achievements.
Eventually, Wilson takes his passion to end slavery to Capitol Hill, where as a senator from Massachusetts, he introduces the District of Columbia Emancipation Act in December of 1861.
The mechanics of the Compensated Emancipation Act were relatively simple. The idea was that slave owners in the District of Columbia would submit essentially claims describing their enslaved persons. These claims, and indeed the enslaved persons, would be evaluated by a dealer in, of all places, Baltimore. Ultimately, slave owners got about an average of $300 per enslaved person. There were over 900 claimants,
Abraham Lincoln signed Wilson's Act into law on April 16, 1862.
D.C. emancipation was celebrated as no other celebration in the African-American community. It was the height of the social season for many years.
Freedom from enslavement in America involved many long and difficult struggles, slave rebellions, attempted escape, and even fighting and dying in a bloody war between the states.
The number of African Americans that fought in the Civil War was approximately 250,000. That would include United States colored troops, African Americans that fought in United States volunteer units, and in the U.S. Navy. The number of African Americans that lost their lives during the Civil War was approximately 40,000.
But wartime sacrifice did not end the struggle for full freedom and equality, nor with the enactment of the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery throughout the United States, nor the 14th Amendment granting blacks their rights as citizens, and not even the 15th Amendment, which granted all men the right to vote. The conscription of black troops in the Civil War began a new chapter in the continuing struggle for freedom, equality, and justice.
When the Civil War began, it was not legal for men of African descent to join the Federal Army. In 1792, Congress had banned the enlistment of men of African descent into the Federal Army. In July of 1862, Congress gave President Lincoln the authority to recruit men of African descent into the Federal Army.
But just how were slaves of African descent convinced to fight in the Civil War? What were they promised? How did they fight? And most importantly, what did they gain?
How does the enslaved African American receive the news that he now has the opportunity to fight and win his freedom? With wild enthusiasm would be the words used by John S. Rock, the first African American to be admitted to the bar of the U.S. Supreme Court. It was with wild enthusiasm that these enslaved Americans could now join the Union Army, fight and win their own freedoms, but not only their own freedom, but the freedom of their own family. They could become the emancipators, the great emancipators, if you will, the liberators of their own families. This was an opportunity of a lifetime.
To assist recruitment efforts, abolitionist Frederick Douglass wrote a newspaper editorial entitled Men of Color to Arms. Douglass urged blacks to earn their equality and show their patriotism by fighting in the Union cause. The Massachusetts 54th Regiment was the first black unit to be formed.
Two of his first recruits were his youngest son, Charles Douglas, and his eldest son, Lewis Douglas, who both enlisted in the 54th Massachusetts when it was first organized in February of 1863. His eldest son, Lewis Douglas, was quite skilled in drill when he got there, and he became the lead drill sergeant of the 54th Massachusetts. The order from the War Department, published in May of 1863, created a separate bureau of the U.S. Army. This separate bureau of the U.S. Army is where all the United States colored troop regiments were mustered into service. So even the 54th Massachusetts, which retained its state designation, was brought in to the Bureau of United States Colored Troops. Although recruitment speeches promised black soldiers equality in the Union Army, they were not treated equally, yet they performed with distinction. Their courage on the battlefield really changed the opinion of many Americans of European descent, because it was very clear after watching those soldiers on the battlefield that men of African descent could, in fact, fight. President Lincoln said that the war against the South could not have been won without the help of the black freedmen.
First Emancipation Day commemoration was celebrated 4 years after the passage of the D.C. Emancipation Act. This was also the first anniversary following the end of the Civil War. And that particular celebration began, people wanted to celebrate it. The war was over, and this was just one of many sort of celebrations around the country.
On April 19, 1866, thousands of spectators lined the streets of D.C. on a sunny day to see the parade. The only visual depiction is a drawing from Harper's Weekly magazine.
What you would see would be the parade beginning at a certain place that had been pre-established. And it would generally open with the president of the parade in sort of an open carriage. And then all of these various militia groups. Following the Civil War, many of the black veterans and persons who had been in what would be equivalent to the National Guard continued these paramilitary activities. Rain or shine, many of the Emancipation Day parades saw rain. The people were still out. They would have umbrellas or they would just be wet and bedraggled. And they marched all over town. Can you imagine marching that distance today? I mean, we can barely go 5 or 6 blocks. These people went all over town. Then after the parade, they would convene at some spot and then have speeches.
The first black person elected to Congress from Virginia, John Mercer Langston, was a regular speaker. He took part in the unveiling of the Emancipation Memorial in Lincoln Park on April 14, 1876.
It depicts a kneeling man of color breaking his chains and a statue then of Lincoln handing him the Emancipation Proclamation.
The monument was funded entirely by the contributions of free slaves. The man, Archer Alexander, was the last person to be captured under the Fugitive Slave Act. Emancipation speeches conveyed awareness by acknowledging the lack of rights for people of color. Not unlike the Civil Rights Act that followed, the Emancipation Act freed slaves on paper, but denial of basic rights continued in practice.
And one of the, actually one of the speakers in one of the Emancipation Day celebrations said this, that the Emancipation Act freed us physically as slaves, but we are still politically slaves. And that is as true today as it was then.
Civil War in 1865 and the ratification of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, slavery was abolished and African Americans were given the right to vote. Despite the progress, newly freed blacks faced an array of daunting social obstacles. To deal with these issues, the Union began an era known as Reconstruction. Senator Charles Sumner of Massachusetts and Representative Thaddeus Stevens were among a group of congressional members known as Radical Republicans, who dedicated themselves to crafting Reconstruction legislation aimed at protecting and educating freedmen until they were able to provide for themselves.
The most important piece of legislation that was introduced by these Radical Republicans was the Bureau of Refugees, Freedmen and Abandoned Lands, or Freedmen Bureau, which was the bureau that was established as a result of public policy to provide education, housing, medical, employment, and opportunities for African Americans.
Established in 1865, the Freedmen's Bureau was headed up by Civil War hero Union Army General Oliver Howard. In his role as commissioner of the bureau, Howard promoted the welfare and education of former slaves.
He played an integral part in establishing schools for African Americans. Howard University is one of those schools that come out of the Freedmen's Bureau and established in 1867, as well as schools here in Washington, D.C., that were established on the land of what we know today as Barrett Farms, a farm that's owned by James Barrett.
Another hero of the Freedmen's Bureau was Massachusetts Senator Henry Wilson. Wilson began his career as a shoemaker, but went on to become a leading abolitionist. Wilson was instrumental in crafting legislation to end slavery and also served as the vice president under Ulysses S. Grant.
After he became vice president and president of the Senate, he continued his roles to fight for African Americans for civil rights and liberties and equalities. And so he's a great hero. I can never emphasize enough that he was author of the D.C. Compensated Emancipation legislation that became law and freed enslaved people here in the District of Columbia, our first on 16 April 1862.
During Reconstruction, former slaves were given the right to vote, and as a result, the nation's first black senators were elected. But the advances would not continue. With the controversial election of 1876 and the Jim Crow laws that followed, much of the historic gains during Reconstruction would evaporate.
The period of 1867 through 1871, this is the period right after the Civil War and before D.C. became a territory, before Congress instituted territorial government in D.C. You have some drastic changes in the city, and it all starts with African Americans petitioning for the right to vote, for universal suffrage. They believe that, particularly with the acquisition of the vote in 1867, they would be able to essentially erect a new social order in the district that would have far-reaching political ramifications. So you had in the city already a black community with its own black elite, and now added to that, you have leaders who have attracted to the city due to government, Congress, and things that have happened, people like Sojourner Truth and Frederick Douglass and others, John Marshall Langston, Augusta Alexander. And you know, they're also attracted to some of the black institutions that have cropped up at this time, such as Howard University and Freedmansville.
By 1871, blacks in the district had made many strides in the quest for equality, but with mounting pressure from whites in the city, Congress and the president instituted the territorial form of government in order to gain control over black political and social mobility.
Frederick Douglass and other blacks will continue to fight for black equality. More specifically, they will push for equal funding of schools, if not the integration of schools in the District of Columbia. And though this fails, other measures do succeed. In 1872, the territorial government will pass another civil rights bill that will end discrimination in places of public accommodation. A $100 fine will be assessed for those who violate it.
But by 1874, Congress eliminated territorial government in the district, taking full control of the city and virtually snuffing out black political power and progress.
So the collapse of the territorial government gave the enemies of black political advancement an opportunity, even if white folks had to suffer it, to check the involvement of blacks in local politics in the nation's capital.
In 1876, controversy surrounded the presidential election of Republican Rutherford B. Hayes. Southern Democrats who supported Samuel Tilden for president refused to concede the race. Their anger was fueled by gains by African Americans, which, among other things, enabled blacks to vote. The stalemate threatened the Union's shaky foundation as a filibuster on Capitol Hill dragged on for weeks, preventing the election of a new president.
As the filibuster continued, they started to work on a compromise, and over the course of several meetings, the last one ending up ironically in the Wormley Hotel, which James Wormley was a local black businessman who had probably the best hotel in Washington at the time. So the compromise was finally worked out whereby the filibustering would stop. The electoral votes would be given to Hayes, and in exchange, federal troops would be withdrawn from the South, and the Southerners would be left to do with the Negroes what they wanted. It really was the death knell for the freedom that had been hard fought and hard won during the Civil War.
Further erosion of the gains made during Reconstruction would intensify following the landmark decision in 1896 by the Supreme Court in Plessy versus Ferguson.
The thing about Plessy was that he was very, very white. He could pass for white and had bought a first-class ticket. So he was in the first-class section, and when the conductor came to take his ticket, said, "I am 1/8 black, and I'm going to sit here in this car." So then the conductor, you know, had no choice but to eject him, call the police in. They arrested him, so he sues, and that's what ended up in the Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court rejected Plessy's argument that his rights as a citizen had been violated when he was ejected from first class. Instead, the court affirmed the legal foundation of segregation policies and the doctrine, separate but equal.
Black activists in this country were, again, naturally alarmed. And at the same time, the violence was increasing and became a part of life. So a group of black intellectuals and activists got together at Niagara Falls and decided, especially because of the disenfranchisement movement going on, that they needed to organize and do something about it. Ironically, they met the next year in Harper's Ferry because that was one of the very few places in this country where a large group of black people could meet. They could get accommodations and so on. Some of that group then met with a group of white intellectuals and decided to form a multiracial group to fight for basically the same things. But the group attracted people of means, and so they named W.E. Du Bois as the face of the organization. They had another conference the next year, and that's when they named it the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and really began to be very aggressive.
While the loss of voting rights was disheartening, additional humiliation came after the inauguration of President Woodrow Wilson. New segregationist policies in federal offices disgraced middle-class African-American civil servants, and federal regulations prohibited African-Americans from sharing public facilities with whites.
When we look at America in 1912, when he launched his inaugural campaign for president, he was a man of the time. We lived in a segregated society. We had Jim Crow, which was affirmed in Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896. So therefore, you have a man who embodied everything that the South represented in himself as the President of the United States. He did this. In 1919, you have the almost a culmination of Wilson's presidency. He will leave office 3 years later. You have a regression of black rights that had been suppressed by the Wilson administration.
Wilson's Southern philosophy of government clashed with the racial advances blacks had become accustomed to since the Civil War.
The riot of July 1919 was a number of riots that actually occurred during the summer of 1919. That's why it's called the Red Summer.
Reaping the benefits of blacks in the military, America continued to repress full rights for its citizens at home.
If we look at the battle against segregation, it's necessary to understand that, again, it's part of the continuum, that our ancestors from the time of the Civil War and before had resisted first slavery and then Jim Crow in an effort to wipe out all injustice, inequality, and indignity. The New Negro Alliance was organized in the 1930s, primarily by Belfort Lawson, but a number of other, if you want to call them, Young Turks. And by that, I mean young people who don't believe the local chapter of the NAACP is moving fast enough or boldly enough. The New Negro Alliance did not take that name lightly. They proceeded to bring what was in their judgment a new look at how to handle and protest racial problems. They brought a new generation of college-trained, insightful black men and women, people like Walter Washington, who's a member of the New Negro Alliance, William Hasty, Robert Weaver, and all of these people are essentially the creme de la creme of the latest generation of battlers against Jim Crow in the nation's capital.
Segregation policies were confronted head-on by the Cultural Revolution of the New Negro Renaissance and the New Negro Alliance.
Sterling Brown and Gene Toomer had local connections to the nation's capital, as did Georgia Douglas Johnson. From her home in 1700 block of F Street, she organized what I call them Saturday riders. They were places that people from a young Aethon Randolph to Langston Hughes could come in a convivial setting, discuss their artistry, discuss their hopes. These discussions might be facilitated by a little alcohol, some good food. But it was a place that was a center for black thought and art for many years.
In 1954, D.C. was one of five cases in which the Supreme Court declared that separate but equal was unconstitutional.
There were five states involved. The difference between Bowling and the other four, and Brown versus Board, is that President James Davis, he was later president of Howard University, fought for Bowling versus Sharp. He was the attorney for that case. And they fought on the grounds that there was segregation, and they wanted the school to be integrated. They just didn't include the school, and they wanted the school to be integrated. This is coming from a push from a group called Consolidated Parents Group. They were out of Anacostia.
we must regard the 60s and the 70s as a special time in the history of African Americans in the District of Columbia for all that it showed. Black businesses, again, the cultural consciousness, the opportunities for black politicians. Yes, indeed, the rise of individuals like Marion Barry, John Wilson, you know, capable people, Nadine Winter, others who were able to leave a mark on this city for many decades afterwards.
By 1960, the federal census documented blacks as a majority racial group in the district, and the black population continued to increase well into the mid-70s.
By 1975, the percentage of African Americans in Washington, D.C. was over 70%, an increase of almost 20% from 1960.
In short, as we take a look at the struggle for justice and dignity in the nation's capital over, let's say, the last 70 or 80 years, there are events that stick out in the mind that speak to the size of the challenge and the depth of the victory. If we take a look at the treatment of black citizens at the dedication of the Lincoln Memorial in 1922, we take a look at the shameful treatment accorded to Marian Anderson by the DAR in 1939. We see examples of some of the hardening nature of Jim Crow. But at the same time, we are comforted by the efforts of African Americans in the nation's capital during the Second World War, those who worked with A. Philip Randolph, those whites of conscience who believed that D.C. should have the right to vote, even if an amendment or a legislation always did not pass, coming all the way down to the vote for president in the early 1960s. These are the attainment of limited home rule in the 1970s. These are important dates.
Freedom, justice, to me meant a lot because citizenship, I thought, was very important for everyone throughout America.
After being denied for 200 years, people in D.C. finally received the right to vote.
Once that vote was secured by us, it allowed us to vote for the President of the United States. What joy we had.
But the victory in 1961 seemed to inspire civil rights leaders even more. With their spirits lifted, a group of community activists called the Black United Front successfully lobbied for home rule.
Crow was among them. Julius Hobson was a leader in Crow there for much of the time. And the Urban League organization from which I came into public life, NAACP, the Association for National Colored People, SCLC was, in effect, Martin Luther King's organization in Washington.
In 1965, President Johnson signed the Home Rule Act, and that Home Rule Act provided for a mayor, a council, but the Congress kept the right to rule over the city. Congress did allow us to elect a non-voting representative who had no authority in the Congress, whatever.
The first elected delegate was Reverend Walter Fauntleroy, a member of the Black United Front.
Reverend Walter Fauntleroy, of course, is one who later went to the first elected city council, including Julius Hobson, who's a very strong activist, Marion Barry, who became a mayor for many say for life, John Wilson, who became the city council chair, David Clark, an attorney, were just among some of the early ones who were there in the community. Jerry Moore, he's one of our great men, great preachers, and great community leaders. It's interesting, Joseph Yeldell is an interesting story because we didn't really hear about Joseph Yeldell until President Lyndon Johnson appointed him to that city council. But we had strong leadership in all of them, and sometimes we were at war with each other on strategies. But our goals were always the same, moving in the same direction all the time.
The African American Civil War Museum opened up in 2000 under the leadership of Dr. Frank Smith Jr., the founding director of the museum. He had a dream to build a memorial to these freedom fighters, and in 1998, he dedicated the African American Civil War Memorial at 10th and E Street to these soldiers. Opened up the museum 2 years later, and at the African American Civil War Museum, we tell the story of these American freedom fighters who marched from slavery to freedom to become the liberators of their own families. These are our forefathers who helped save the Union, abolish slavery, and establish democracy. In fact, all Americans should be grateful to these Americans who make it possible for us today, in good faith, to pledge our allegiance to an indivisible republic, a republic they helped keep together, with liberty and justice for all. They fought expressly to extend the blessings of liberty to all Americans. These are American freedom fighters, and all Americans should be proud of them, grateful to them, and especially Americans of Africa.
In 1991, the superintendent of the public schools asked everybody to be involved with the anniversary of Washington, D.C. That was a bicentennial of the District of Columbia. So we, Reading is Fundamental, was very active in the public schools, and Reading the Road to Freedom and that kind of thing. So what we did is got together, started researching from the very beginning of the history of the District of Columbia. And it was in 1991 that we reestablished the emancipation of the District of Columbia. From then on, the celebrations have gone on from there. And now it's legal public holiday in the district. But it's through our research and all the people in the city, the students, the children, and everybody involved in getting this on a good footing. My vision is to see it celebrated in every block and ward in the city. And I feel that if the citizens are involved in their own communities with their own celebrations, parades, or just getting together and maybe putting little posters in their windows, and we would just like to see it revived in an educational manner so that everybody in every ward would know what it's about.
In 2003, the celebration was revived by citizens who recognized its relevance. Politicians also saw a way to connect the celebration with the hope for freedom in the nation's capital during this century. To protest the district's lack of voting rights, advocates organized a rally at the Emancipation Day celebration in 2007.
Continuing with the Emancipation celebration, it's clear, as it was not so clear then, that the whole idea of enslavement affected not just black people, not just people of color, but all residents of the district and the United States. And so today's denial of voting rights for citizens of the district is really the same thing. It affects not just us, but it affects all of our residents.
While they have changed over the years, the principle behind Emancipation Day celebrations have remained the same.
So it's an opportunity to reflect in whatever way, whether you want to go to a church and hear speeches, as they did in the 19th century, or whether you want to have a parade, as they did in the 19th century. So-called sophisticated people in the community in the 19th century just abhorred the fact that, you know, young colored women would dance to bands, you know. But that was the way of celebrating. So if that's what you want to do, you know, in this century, however you choose to do so, I think the celebration ought to continue just to remind us what it used to be, what it is today, and what it can be.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you've just been receiving a litany of various elements concerning slavery all the way up to the present time. It took pretty close to an hour to provide it, but I think it was worthwhile in the sense that you had an opportunity to see what black people went through all the way back into 1600s, all the way up to the present time. And it hasn't stopped. It's continued. There seemed to be some kind of air to believe that certain things are going to change. I don't know whether they are going to change, and I don't have that innate ability to feel that certain things are going to change. We're still waiting for the voting rights to occur. And that hasn't occurred yet. And I think they're trying to name it after John Lewis. But I initially began our discussion today about if we're not knowledgeable about slavery, we're subject to repeat it in history. We need to pay close attention today to all the various kinds of things that are happening in Washington, D.C., in the White House, because we have people there who are governing us who have really negative intentions in dealing with us as human beings. It's apparent every day. And if this person is allowed to continue, we might have some problems of going back further than we already have. When that policeman kneeled down on a black man's neck, it's like a form of lynching. And I think when people saw it, like they saw what happened during the civil rights movement of when we were trying to march in the waters, I lived through that. I was a part of that. And the dogs biting at you and people beating on you with police clubs. Not only did I live through it, I didn't get involved with that particular element of it, but I was involved with people talking about it in Connecticut, where I was a teacher at the time. So We seem like we came a long way with the selection of a female to now be the vice, function as the person being nominated for the presidency, and as well as the black from Oakland, California, as a vice president. I'm hopeful that this particular thing will have a major indent on how we proceed. But I don't get some positive vibes about how some people are treated even today, both who are black and being treated by black, and those who are white who treat black people so inhumane. I think I'm going to change the subject. I have some time left. There was a famous singer by the name of Sam Cooke. As a child, I remember going to see him sing with a religious group called the Soul Stirrers, which he performed at the Pearl Street Neighborhood House on Pearl Street, which is a community center in Waterbury. And he and the five blind boys and the Soul Stirrers sang, and with the music and everything, it was Sam Cooke at that particular time was maybe 2 or 3 years older than I was at the time. He couldn't have been more than about 15 years old, but I remember seeing him perform. And then, really, after I was in school in college, he left singing with the Soul Stirrers and started singing on his own. And I'd like for you to hear a little bit about him, because he was shot and killed a lot of really well-known entertainers, musicians, have lost their lives either through drugs or someone else just walking up to them and shooting them. I can remember that same thing happened to a famous trumpet player. But let me get back while we still have time to Sam Cooke, and maybe next week we'll talk about that. Here's Sam Cooke, What Really Happened.
Sam Cooke, who's one of the most famous singers between 1957 and 1964. He had 30 or more number one hits, and being that famous, always leave a trail of haters, speaking of current slang, of course. But then racist, greedy, and jealous people who will always love to destroy you. But before I go into that, here's a brief summary about him for those who didn't know him. Samuel Cooke, that's without the E, was born on January 22, 1931 in Clarksville, Mississippi. In 1957, he added an E at the end of his name. The reason for the change, no one knows. He was the fifth of eight children of Reverend Charles Cooke, a minister in the Church of Christ, Holiness, and his wife, Anna Mae. One of his younger brothers, L.C., later became a member of the doo-wop band, Johnny Keys and the Magnificent. The family moved to Chicago in 1933, where Sam attended Doolittle Elementary and Wendell Phillips Academy High School in Chicago, the same school that Nat King Cole had attended a few years earlier. Sam Cooke began his career with his siblings in a group called the Singing Children when he was 6 years old. He first became known as a singer with the Highway QCs when he was just a teenager, and having joined the group at the age of 14. During this time, Sam befriended fellow gospel singer and neighbor Lou Rawls, who sang in a rival gospel group in 1950. Sam Cooke replaced gospel tenor R.H. Harris as lead singer of the gospel group The Soul Stirrers, founded by R.H. Harris, who had signed with Specialty Records on behalf of the group. Their first recording under Sam's leadership was the song Jesus Gave Me Water in 1951. They also recorded the gospel songs Peace in the Valley, How Far Am I from Canaan, Jesus Paid the Debt, and One More River, among many others, some of which he wrote. Sam also was often credited for bringing gospel music to the attention of younger crowds of listeners, mainly girls, who were rushed to the stage when the Soul Stirrers hit the stage just to get a glimpse of Sam. This attraction with the ladies will become part of the death of him. Now, his first pop-slash-soul single was called Lovable in 1957, a remake of the gospel song Wonderful. It was released under the alias Dale Cooke in order not to alienate his gospel fan base. There was a considerable stigma against gospel singers performing secular music. However, it fooled no one. Sam's unique and distinctive vocals were easily recognized. Art Ruby, head of Specialty Records and the label of the Soul Stirrers, gave his blessings for Sam to record secular music under his name. But he was unhappy about the type of music Sam and producer Bumps Blackwell were making. Ruby expected Sam's secular music to be similar to that of another Specialty Record, other artists such as Little Richard. When Ruby walked in on a recording session and heard Sam covering Gershwin, he was quite upset. Ruby and Blackwell began to argue, and then Sam and Blackwell left the label. In 1957, then Sam appeared on ABC's The Guy Mitchell Show. That same year, he signed with Keen Records. His first release, You Send Me, spent 6 weeks at number one on the Billboard R&B charts. After that, he was on fire, and the higher he got, the more problems he got, especially at that time period. In 1961, he started his own label with J.W. Alexander and his manager, Roy Crane, called SAR Records. The label soon included the Sims twins, Valentinos, who were Bobby Womack and his brothers. Now, Bobby Womack and Johnny Taylor, Sam then created a publishing and print and management firm named CAGS before leaving Keen to sign with RCA Victor. One of his first RCA singles was Chain Gang, which reached number 2 in the Billboard pop chart. It was followed by more hits, including Sad Mood, Cupid, Bring It Home to Me, with Lou Rawls on the backing vocals, of course, Another Saturday Night, and Twisted the Night Away. Like the most R&B artists of his time, Sam focused on singles. In all, he had about 29 top 40 hits on the pop charts, and it was growing, and pretty much more on the R&B charts. He was a prolific songwriter and wrote most of his songs he recorded. He also had a hand in overseeing some of the song arrangements. In spite of releasing mostly singles, he released a well-received blues inflicted LP in 1963 called Night's Beat, and his most critically acclaimed studio album, Ain't That Good News, which featured 5 singles in 1964. In 1963, Sam signed a 5-year contract for Allen Klein to manage Cax Music and SAR Records and made him his manager. Allen negotiated a 5-year deal with 3 years plus 2 option years with RCA, in which a holding company called Tracy Limited, named after Sam's daughter, owned by Allen and managed by J.W. Alexander, which produced and owned Sam's recordings. RCA will get exclusive distribution rights in exchange for 6% royalty payments and payments for the recording sessions. For tax reasons, Sam would receive preferred stock in Tracy Limited instead of an initial of a cash advance of $100,000. Sam would also receive cash advances in the amount of $100,000 for the next 2 years. Now, followed by additional $75,000 for each of the 2 option years if the deal went to term. Now, this was a good deal for that time, but let's get realistic. Sam was worth millions, okay? Now, Sam was married twice. His first marriage was to singer-dancer Dolores Elizabeth Milligan Cook, who was killed in an auto accident in Fresno, California in 1959. Although he and Dolores were divorced, Sam still paid for his ex-wife's funeral expenses. Sam and his second wife, Barbara Campbell Cook, had 3 children. Linda was born in 1953, and then Tracy was born in 1960, and then Vincent, who was born in 1961 and allegedly drowned in the family swimming pool in 1963, unfortunately. Sam also had fathered at least 3 other children out of wedlock, and sorry, the names aren't mentioned. Sam had died on December 11, 1964. He was 33 years old. He died at the Hacienda Motel located in Los Angeles, California. There were many reports of a shooting and a kidnapping at the motel. Police had found Sam's body wearing only his burst jacket and shoes, but no shirt, pants, or underwear. He had sustained a gunshot wound to the chest, which was later determined to have pierced his heart. The motel's manager, Bertha Franklin, said she had shot Sam in self-defense after he broke into her office residence and attacked her. Her account was immediately questioned and disputed by acquaintances. The official police record states that Bertha fatally shot Sam, who had checked in earlier that evening. Bertha claimed that Sam had broken into the manager's office in rage, wearing nothing but a shoe and a sports coat, demanding to know the whereabouts of a woman who had accompanied him at the motel, claiming that he had been robbed. Bertha said she told Sam that the woman was not there, but allegedly the enraged Sam supposedly did not believe her and violently grabbed her, demanding again to know the woman's whereabouts. Now, remember, this was in the late 50s and the beginning of civil rights. Now, according to Bertha, she tussled with Sam, and the 2 of them fell to the floor, and then she got up and ran to retrieve a gun. She said then she fired at Sam in self-defense because she feared for her life. Sam was then struck once in the torso. According to Bertha, he painfully then spoke, "Lady, you shot me," before mounting the last charge of her. She said then she beat him over the head with a broomstick before he finally fell from being mortally wounded by the gunshot. The motel's owner, Evelyn Carr, claimed that she had been on the telephone with Franklin at the time of the incident. I guess the lady dragged the cord phone around with her the whole entire time, I guess. Anyway, Evelyn also claimed to have overheard Sam's intrusion and the ensuing conflict and gunshots. She also claimed to have called the police and requested officers to go to the motel, telling them she believed that a shooting had occurred. And a coroner inquest was convened to investigate the incident. The woman who accompanied Sam to the motel was identified as Elsa foyer and had also called the police that night shortly before Evelyn had. Now, Elsa claimed to have calls from a telephone booth near the motel telling them she had just escaped from being kidnapped. Elsa claims to have told the police that she had first met Sam earlier that night and had spent the evening in his company. She claimed that after they left the local nightclub together, she had repeatedly requested that he take her home, but he instead took her against her will to the Hacienda Motel. She claimed that once they were in the motel room, Sam typically forced her onto the bed, and that she was certain he was going to rape her. Right. According to Elsa, when Sam stepped into the bathroom for a moment, she quickly grabbed her clothes and ran from the room. She claimed that in her haste, she had also scooped up most of Sam's clothing by mistake. I bet she did. She said she ran first to the manager's office and knocked on the door seeking help. However, she said that the manager took too long in responding, so fearing Sam would soon be coming after her, she fled from the motel before the manager ever opened the door. She said she then put her clothing back on, hid Sam's clothing, and then went to a telephone booth and called the police. Now, Elsa's story is the only account of what allegedly happened between her and Sam that night. However, her story has long been called into question, with inconsistencies between her versions of events and details reported by other witnesses, as well as circumstantial evidence suggested that Elsa may have gone literally to the motel with Sam, well, I don't know if many other women at that time, I'm sure. She then slipped out of the room with his clothing to rob him rather than to escape an attempted rape. Others also question about Elsa's role were beyond the scope of the inquest, the purpose of which was only to establish the circumstances of Bertha's role in the shooting. Elsa leaving a motel room with almost all of Sam's clothes, and the fact that tests showed Sam was inebriated at the time provided a plausible explanation to the inquest jurors for Sam's bizarre behavior and a state of dress. In addition, because of Evelyn's testimony, they coincidentally collaborated with Bertha's versions of events. And because both Elsa and Bertha later allegedly passed a lie detector test, so the coroner's jury ultimately accepted Bertha's explanation and returned a verdict of justifiable homicide, with then the verdict authorities officially closing the case on Sam Cook's death. But some of Sam's family and supporters, however, have rejected Elsa's version of events, as well as those given by Bertha and Evelyn. They believed that there was a conspiracy to murder Sam and that the murder took place in some other manner entirely different from their official accounts. Singer Etta James viewed Sam's body before his funeral and had questioned the accuracy of the official version of events. She wrote that the injuries she observed were well beyond the official account of Sam's having fought Bertha, a woman, alone. Etta also wrote that Sam was also so badly beaten that his head was nearly separated from his shoulders. His hands were broken and crushed, and his nose was mangling. So people speculated that Sam's manager, Alan Klein, might have had a role in his death. You see, Alan owned Tracy Limited, as I stated earlier, which ultimately owned all the rights to Sam's recordings, meaning that he may have hired these women to lie about what really occurred, and they may have also hired someone to beat and then kill poor Sam, all because of money. But unfortunately, no concrete evidence supporting any criminal conspiracy that has been presented yet, so these just remain theories. Tell me yours below. Okay, first of all, Sam met prostitute Elsa in an Italian restaurant named Martoni's. Okay, he was having dinner with producer Al Schmidt and Schmidt's wife, Joan. Sam had already had three or four martinis. He eventually got pulled away to the bar. When their orders arrived, Al Schmidt went to get Sam and found him laughing it up with a group of friends and music business associates. Sam was buying, and then he flashed the water bills, what looked like thousands of dollars. He told Al that he and his wife should just go ahead with their meal. At a booth near the bar, there was a baby-faced 22-year-old Asian girl named Elsa Boyer sitting with three guys. Sam caught her eye. He'd seen her around before. One of the guys, a guitar player Sam knew, introduced them. Before long, the pair were cozied up in a booth. They left Martoni's around 1 a.m. in Sam's brand-new red Ferrari and headed to a nightclub called PJ's, where they were going to meet the Schmitz. By the time they arrived, the Schmitz were gone in the club. Sam got into a heated argument with some guy who was hitting on Elsa. She claimed then she asked Sam to take her home, and they left at around 2 a.m. Now, according to Elsa, Sam raced down Santa Monica and against her protest, pulled onto the freeway. She later told police that she asked again to be taken home, but Sam said, "Don't worry now, I just want to go for a little ride." He stroked her hair and told her how pretty she was. They exited the highway near LAX. Elsa said she asked again to be taken home, but Sam drove straight to the Hacienda Motel. He got out of the car and walked up to the glass partition at the manager's office while Elsa remained in the car. He registered under his own name with the clerk, Bertha Franklin. Bertha eyed Elsa in the car and told Sam that he had to sign in as Mr. and Miss. Okay, there are many problems here. Let's start with Elsa Barrett. She testified that she met Sam at a Hollywood dinner party and that he sang a song at the party. No mention of Martoni's or PJ's. She said she was kidnapped by Sam and couldn't escape because his car was going too fast. Yet when Sam went to the motel window to register, Elsa was left alone in the car, remember? She couldn't have escaped or yelled for help then. Moreover, if it was Sam's intention to rape Elsa, why would he have registered under his real name? Elsa also said she mistakenly took Sam's clothes from the room when she grabbed her own. Wouldn't it make sense that she was merely trying to prevent his pursuit? And what about the wad of cash that she spied earlier on in that night? Surely she knew where it was. Can we say thief? Okay, now here's the truth about Elsa that came about a month later after this event, and she was arrested for prostitution. The Hacienda Motel, which offered $3 an hour per rate, was known as a hangout for hookers. What probably happened is that Sam paid for Elsa's services, and when he stepped into the bathroom, she ran out with his cash and credit cards, which pissed him off and anyone in that position. Anyway, in 1979, Elsa was found guilty of second-degree murder in the death of a boyfriend, whereas he was trying to defend himself because she was robbing him blind, too. Now, as for Bertha Franklin, an ex-madam who knew Elsa, by the way, and had her own criminal record and was forced to quit her job after receiving several death threats, she also tried to file a $200,000 lawsuit against Sam Cooke Estate for punitive damages and injuries, but she lost. As for Barbara Cook, her husband, infidelity was nothing new to her, but she also had some action going on the side with a local bartender on the day of Sam's funeral. This guy was seen wearing Sam's watch and his ring 2 months after Sam's death. Barbara had dumped the bartender, of course, and married Sam's friend, a backup singer, you know, Bobby Womack. Now, for Sam's part, he was always a womanizer, as friend Bumps Blackwell once said. Sam would literally walk past a good girl to get to a whore. There were all kinds of theories around his death, such as a drug deal involving someone close to Sam in which Sam tried to intervene because Sam doesn't do drugs. He only drinks, even though it was rumored that he barely drunk either. He may have a couple of drinks and that's it. So I don't know what's going on with this night. Moving on. Or there's another theory, whereas maybe it was a mafia hit, a setup devised by jealous Barbara Cook, you know, his wife. Then many believe it was a racist plot in the entertainment business, as with any rising star, not to mention one of color in the, you know, in the early 1960s and late 50s. Sam had made timidity because he was making reality of his plan to not have no white man end up with everything that he made and worked for. You see, Sam was just getting too big for his britches and also for an African-American man at the time. So I believe that Sam was lured into a trap at the Hacienda Motel where Elsa Barrera and Bertha Franklin were working in Tatum. I believe his gold digger slut wife had something to do with it, probably. She may have had her man on the side, but she was still his wife, whom he was cheating on. I believe that hooker Elsa Bertha and his psychopath wife, whom I'm very suspicious of, the death of their son drowning in the pool, were all hired by Alan Klein to set up Sam and have him killed. The men in the club were probably the ones that beat Sam to death because Bertha was only 30 pounds heavier, and a broom handle wouldn't have done that much damage to them to decapitate someone. It is crazy what people would do for money. Please tell me your theories below.
Documentary on Sam Cooke, who, as when I was real young, used to marvel at how easy it was for him to hit certain notes. This is the first time I've ever heard what was called the truth of what really happened to Sam Cooke. And there were just too many pieces missing that he probably was robbed and shot. He was a womanizer. That was a fact. Not from my knowledge of people that I've talked with, but the people who are and were in the music business with me when I was traveling around and singing. But what's so remarkable about him, he left us a load of music. And his voice was so smooth. And I know that when I said, I didn't know he was born in 1930, so he was much older than me. But the point of the matter is that he was a great performer and could set a mood in a minute. In any event, this has been Getting It Done. And I have been your host, Dr. Walter Dean, and hopefully you've enjoyed both of the segments that were provided. And looking forward to us being able to get together again on Monday. And at that particular time, we will produce something else that would be of your interest as well as hopefully to your liking. So have a good weekend and take care of yourself and stay away from the sicknesses we're experiencing on our planet. Bye-bye.